Good morning, family. Good morning. I'm always thankful to be in front of you. There's no better group to preach to and to be able to be a part of than, at least in my opinion, than here at Church of the Canyons. And just very thankful for the opportunity. Thankful for the end of the year, which is normally my time slot to come up and preach. We have Pastor Bob and Pastor Roger on vacation. And so in some sense, they rattle the cage and let the young guy out and then put me back in. So real thankful for you guys. And part of what I'm going to preach on is just something that we've been working through in the college ministry, and something in which I think you'll benefit greatly from. I know that I have, and a number of other people have really been challenged by, and that's the book of James. We're going to be looking at that. And the title for today's sermon is A New Perspective for the New Year. And when you come to this understanding of new, a lot of things come to mind, at least in my mind. You think of new, I think of that new car smell. Whether you have it or not, you can buy little air fresheners to put in there, right? That just the newness of a car, the excitement of a new car, or new job with the potentials and new people and new responsibilities. And then the new year, which is fastly approaching us. I mean, just a couple days and we will be celebrating 2014. And that just seems unbelievable to me. And I think a little bit has to do with the fact that we lost that week, that extra week that we have with Thanksgiving. It just feels like everything is just blended together. Either that or I'm getting old, so one or the other. And I'm going to choose the first. And so, a new year. And we celebrate a new year because we celebrate, in a sense, a fresh start. A new year means a new start, untapped potential. We celebrate a new year in style. Most people do, right? They have the goofy glasses with the numbers and the parties and drop the ball in New York. And if you look at those people, they're all excited. Some of them have helped being excited at that hour. And so when you think of the new year, there's excitement. And part of that excitement is because it's unknown. If you're my Facebook friend, I'm probably not talking about you. So if I am, just forgive me. But I've looked at a number of Facebook statuses over the last couple weeks, knowing what I was going to preach on in a particular prepping for it. And there are a lot of statuses really looking forward to 2013 ending. At least I'm from Jersey, and so a lot of my Jersey friends are like, man, I'm looking forward. They use some choice words, but they're really looking forward to the end of 2013. And I read an article just yesterday that says that out of the Americans that they polled, 2/3 would characterize 2013 as a bad year. 2/3. Now, again, I don't know how polling works and statistics and all that stuff. Who knows? Maybe they polled 3 people and 2 people had a bad day. Don't know. But 2/3, a bad year. And the article ended saying, simply put, Americans are ready for 2013 to end. And I just wonder, they probably were ready for 2012 to end. And 2011 and so on and so forth. Because in reality, though the new year has new beginnings and a fresh start and unknown possibilities, we all know that trials are going to come. We don't know what's coming, but we know something is. Because that's just the nature of life. When you look at what people have gone through, even if you open up your bulletin and you look at the prayer requests, I mean, there are struggling people even in our midst this past year. People who are struggling with relationships, broken marriages, fighting amongst themselves, people who are struggling with finances, no job, or they hate the job that they're in, people who are struggling with health. We have a lot of people struggling with health issues, some even here this morning. There's a number of things that we wrestle with. And while there's excitement with the new year, there's also some challenges with the new year as we come in and we prep. And really, we're going to look at James chapter 1. And I would invite you to turn to James 1. James 1, we're going to be in 1 through 12. And James chapter 1 is pretty familiar to a lot of us. I mean, think of James chapter 1 in particular, probably one of the most familiar is the basic phrase, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you avoid various trials." All right? Is that what your version says? Somebody scratch out encounter and put avoid. That's what we would like it to say, if we were honest. Because we would count it joy to avoid any pain and suffering whatsoever. Yet James calls us to something very unnatural. Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. A new perspective for a new year really isn't about anything new in content. I'm pretty sure you're not going to learn anything new. Maybe you will, but for the most of us, this is stuff we know. Rejoice. Be joyful in the midst of difficulties and trials and tribulations and circumstances that are hard and difficult. So it's not about new in concept, but I think a lot of us, maybe it's new in application. As we go into the new year, when trials come your way, what's your first response? And we can just totally talk about the fact that it says various trials. So little or big, long or short, when trials come your way, do you respond with complaining? Do you respond with anger, bitterness, frustration? Do you respond with fear, despair, hopelessness, worry, anxiousness? We probably respond a number of ways depending on what the trial is. But trials are very real, and they're going to be here for the new year. And Lord willing, we'll have our roof for this morning. But trials will come. And the question is, are we prepared for them? As we celebrate a new year, my encouragement to you and to myself, having worked through this passage a number of times, is that we see it as joy. It's unnatural, but we see trials as joy. So I'm going to give you the 3 points. It's pretty simple, and then we'll go through and work through it. Point number one, the attitude in trials. And it'll come up on the board in case you missed it. The attitude in trials. Point number two, the advantage of trials. The advantage of trials. And the third point, see, I'm a good TMS graduate, 3 points. The third point, the assistance for trials. One of the things that I love, and I'm just going to kind of paint the picture before we open up in prayer and jump in and then move forward, is that James is going to say, consider it joy when you encounter trials because it tests your faith, and that testing produces endurance, which brings about maturity so that you can be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if you lack, then ask for wisdom. I love how he moves from attitude to thinking about the advantages of, then moving towards when you lack, because it's not going to be an if, when you lack in dealing with the right attitude with trials, then ask for assistance. So that's what we're going to look at. So let's open up in prayer and we'll jump in. I didn't pray to begin with, did I? Okay. I get confused when I preach two messages. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for just giving us your word, for giving us James. Thanks for giving us trials and challenges and difficulties. Father, I pray that those that are struggling even today with their responses to the difficulties in their lives, that you would bring encouragement to them, that they would be encouraged to trust you, to be joyful, to seek you for assistance. Father, I do ask that those who maybe were not currently experienced trials, that this would be a reminder and help prepare us for when they come. But ultimately, Father, may we honor you. May we fix our eyes on Jesus. May we have an eternal perspective, even in the temporary difficulties. And may we see these as opportunities for you to grow us and change us. We pray that to be true. In your son's name, amen. Let me give a little bit of background to James, and then we'll just jump in. James, the writer, is the brother of Jesus. James wasn't a Christian, wasn't a believer when Jesus was walking around doing his ministry. James becomes a Christian after Jesus goes to the cross, dies, is resurrected, and he sees the resurrected Christ. In the book of John, John tells us that his brothers did not believe in him. In fact, his brothers thought that Jesus was crazy. And yet this guy, who thought his brother was crazy, meets his brother, who is the Son of God, resurrected in all his glory, becomes a believer, and begins to rise up in leadership in the Jerusalem church. And James writes this book. It's probably, most likely, the first New Testament book written. It's probably the first one. It's probably the oldest New Testament book that we have. And James is writing to Jewish believers. Look at verse 1. Who is it addressed to? To the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. And in fact, if you were to look at the book, there are numerous clues that show you that this is a Jewish context. He uses the Greek term for synagogue. He'll use a number of different things that are Jewish in nature. And James is writing to Jewish believers, most likely who were scattered after the death of Stephen. You guys remember Stephen, right? Acts chapter 7, he preaches this message, he gets stoned and killed, and the believers spread abroad. That's when Saul starts his persecution, and he goes to Damascus to persecute Jewish believers. Most likely James, who is the leader, by the time we get to Acts 15, James is the leader of the Jerusalem church. He's the one that, in a sense, that they defer to. He's the spokesman when we look at Acts 15. And so probably what's happening here is that James is writing to Jewish believers who have been run out of Jerusalem, who are dispersed abroad, and he's writing to them for several reasons. If you look at the book as a whole, and we're just going to take a really fast little, basically ski through the whole book, is in chapter 1, he deals with trials in life. And then he'll move to addressing temptations and not falling into temptation to sin. And then he'll move to say that the God above is a good God who gives good gifts. And then he'll go forward and he'll talk about the need to be a doer of the word. It's in chapter 1. And he ends chapter 1 telling these Jewish believers to minister to and take care of the poor and the widows and the orphans. And chapter 2 is probably one of the most challenging chapters. He urges the church there to have a faith that works, an active faith. Chapter 3 is probably most familiar to us. Chapter 3, he deals with what I like to call the little red rebel. That's the tongue. So not only be a doer of the word, but guard your words. Chapter 4, he'll deal with this issue of quarrels and conflicts. What's the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? It's you. It's you. It's the war that's raging inside of you. The desire for pleasure. In chapter 5, he'll end with calling the poor Jewish believers to be patient because they're having their wages withheld. They're even dying. And he says, be patient and look to the return of Christ. That's how the book of James is kind of situated. So in a nutshell, I like to see it as this. The theme of James, in my opinion, is that James writes to believers, calling them to live a wise and mature life, even in the most difficult circumstances. Live in a wise and mature way. Be mature. And then he'll give descriptions of what that maturity looks like. Following faithfully after God, helping the poor, the widows, and the orphans, making sure your speech is right. All of those things really wrap up into this idea of being mature. And he starts off with this idea of having joy in trials. Now, when you think of joy in trials, it's probably one of those things where you say, yeah, I've heard that over and over again, but that doesn't make sense. Because naturally, it's difficult. So the first point we have here is this, the attitude in trials. And I've already said it, but in verse 2, it says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Consider it all joy. That's probably the last thing that most people think when they think trials. Difficulties. Challenges. Financial issues. Health issues. The loss of a loved one. All of these things that come into our lives, the last thing we think is, oh, joy. And yet this isn't a new concept. James is basically piggybacking off of what Jesus says in Luke chapter 6. This is what Jesus says. Blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you and insult you and scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way, their fathers used to treat the prophets. Here's what Jesus is saying. He's dealing with persecution. He's talking to the disciples about persecution that's going to come. And he says, be glad and leap for joy. And the other aspect of it is here in this the second part, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. How does Jesus relate this? He says, you can be glad, you can have joy, because you have eternity to look forward to, an eternal perspective. So even in persecution, even when men hate you and ostracize you and insult you and scorn you, don't be surprised when they do that. Don't be surprised when the world hates you for taking a stand. Don't be surprised when a cable company kicks you off the program for speaking out against homosexuality. Don't be surprised about those things. Be glad. Rejoice. For your reward is great. Here he's doing two things. He's calling them to have joy, and in having joy, to look to the future. And that's going to be a theme, even in James. Look at James chapter 1 again. Look how it starts off. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. And then in verse 12, he ends our section with this. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trials. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. And so here he bookends this idea of trials and ends it with this pointing to future reward. When we come to chapter 1, verse 2, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. That this idea for consider is important. Notice that James does not say trials are joy. He doesn't say that. Because only crazy people would think that way. Right? Crazy people. I'm going through the worst time of my life. This is awesome. That would be a crazy person, right? That's not what James is saying. What he is saying is this. Consider it joy. Most times when we come into trials in our lives, difficulties, our reaction is usually an emotional response. Bitterness, anger, frustration, depression, despair, anxiety, worry, all those things that we listed off. What he's saying here is that make a conscious mental note that this trial that's difficult is really a source of joy. And you look at that, and if you're normal, you say, what? That's crazy. Like, it's unnatural, is what it is. It's not the natural human response to a trial. The natural human response is to escape trials. The natural human response to a headache is not to say, I'm going to endure it. The natural human response is, I'm going to Excedrin it. Right? Consider it joy. The key here, the attitude, is that you have to mentally think through that this trial that's difficult, that's hurting, that's painful, that's challenging, you have to mentally rethink about how you think about these things. Consider it joy. Now, easier said than done, right? Consider it joy. When you encounter what kind of trials? Various, right? So not like consider it joy when you encounter easy trials, because you escape the hard ones. Or consider it joy when you really endure the most difficult ones. Here, what he's getting at is this, is that trials are going to come into all shapes and sizes. We know that. We can just look at the last year, even in our lives. They're gonna be all sorts of shapes and sizes, and when they come, we have to mentally prepare to think about it as a source of joy. And do you know who the greatest example is? It's a Sunday school answer, so you can answer it. Jesus, right? Here in Hebrews chapter 12, the writer of Hebrews says this, "Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostilities by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." Here the writer of Hebrews, who, interestingly enough, is addressing Jewish people, telling them, look at Jesus, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. We just celebrated Christmas not too long ago, right? It's pretty recent. Baby Jesus in the manger. The reality of it is that Christmas is just the part of the story. Baby Jesus' first steps were steps towards the cross. He came and was born to die. And Jesus endured the shame of the cross. He endured the horrific punishment, both physically and spiritually, the wrath of God poured on him. How did he do it? They say, well, I'm Jesus. Yeah, he is. How did he do it? The writer of Hebrews tells us that for the joy set before him, what's the joy? Right there. Sitting at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus endured the cross looking to future, an eternal perspective. Do you see the common theme that's happening here? He talked about it. James talks about it. The writer of Hebrews talks about it. Having joy in the midst of trials really is counterculture. Because we think of the here and now. Years ago, there was an old Burger King commercial. I want it my way, right away. We're the microwave culture, right? If we wait more than 5 minutes in a drive-thru, that's too long, unless you're going to In-N-Out. Then you realize that it's not really In-N-Out. It's drive and wait, right? We want what we want right away. Eternal perspective looks to the future, and it can look at temporary difficulties and endure it with joy because there's something better to come. But that's only for believers. Paul says it best, I think, in 2 Corinthians, where he says, we endure momentary light affliction for the weight of eternal glory. And think about the contrast there. Momentary light affliction, eternal weight of glory. Joy. That's probably the easiest point, right? We know what the attitude should be. It should be joy. But here's the second point. Part of what helps us have joy and having an eternal perspective, part of what helps us have joy is the advantage of trials. Let's look at verses 3 and 4. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. This is the advantage of a trial. There's a number of them here. Look at the first word here in verse 3. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Again, verse 2, what are we to do? Consider or think trials as a source of joy. Why? Because we should know that the trial is a testing of our faith. And when you think of trial, usually we put in the category of trial the definition of trouble and grief. I'm going through a trial. It's trouble and grief. But trial also has another meaning to it. Trial also has this idea of testing and examining to see the genuineness of something. When you go on trial for a crime, the whole thing is designed to test and examine to see whether you are innocent. When a product is in the trial phase, they're testing to see if it works. So here we have this interesting part of the advantage of trials is that the trial here is actually to test you, to see what's there. One of my favorite illustrations, and I don't remember who did it, so I can't give him credit. It was years ago. He likened circumstances and trials to a sponge. So just picture this. A sponge in a sink full of dirty dishwater. And you know when I mean dirty, we're talking gross, right? Like not clear, murky. That sponge is in the bottom. If you grab it, pull it out, and squeeze it, what happens? Yeah, what kind of water comes out? Clean, crystal clear. Like you grab a dirty, soapy dishwater and squeeze it to drink from? No, because it's gross water. The idea of a trial is just that. A trial squeezes you, and guess what comes out? What's in there? I mean, think about it. Last time you went through a trial, yesterday, today, last week, this whole year. When that pressure squeezes you, when the pressure of life and the circumstances squeeze you, what comes out? Bitterness, frustration, anger, complaining. The list can go on, right? So basically, trials are designed by God, in a sense. He puts them into your life to test your faith, to see where you're at. For some, it's going to test the genuineness of even if you have genuine faith. For others, if you're a believer and you do have genuine faith, maybe the maturity of your faith. But it tests. And that testing will produce endurance. I no longer make New Year's resolutions because they usually end New Year's Day. So I've decided New Year's resolutions are done. I make year-long, I'm going to work on this. You can call it a New Year's resolution if you want. But for me, it's like, no, this is a year-long. This is what I want to accomplish this year. And part of what I want to accomplish, and you can hold me accountable because you'll see me, is I want to lose weight and exercise. That's, especially after a comatose Christmas. Right? The fat belly, shut eye, food comas that we've all endured. But I know, because I've had to go through it, the whole struggle with weight up and down type of thing. I know the best way for me to lose weight is the best way for anybody to lose weight. Eat less, exercise more. It's pretty simple. It's not rocket science, right? Yet I know when I start running, I'm going to hate life for a couple weeks. And the first couple times that I go running, it's basically going to be called a shuffle, right? I'm going to shuffle through the paseos. It's going to be a shuffle shuffle, if you remember Goonies. But what happens after doing that for a number of weeks? You build stamina and endurance, and you go longer, farther, harder, faster. And trials do that. They test you to show you where you're at spiritually. they also produce endurance, which, look at verse 4, and let endurance have its perfect result so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And the idea here is perfect and complete is this issue of being mature, the perfect part, and complete or whole. It's not perfection. What it's saying here, and it's often used in terms of maturity. Let endurance have its perfect result that you would be matured by it. What's the advantage of a trial? Well, I'm from the East Coast, and we've worked through this passage in college group, and so I've taught my college kids to think of it like this. You ready? Trials are opportunities. Now you say it. Trials are opportunities. Now, saying it that goofy, it sticks in your head. In fact, I know of one college student who got into a car accident and came up to me a couple days later and said, you know, as I was going through that situation, I was reminded that it's an opportunity. And then, you know, he said, opportunity. Because it's a fancy way of remembering. Well, it's not fancy, right? It's a fancy way of remembering that there are opportunities for growth, to show you where you're at. When you go through a trial and you don't respond rightly, guess what that tells you? Well, we can be negative and say, I'm a sinner. Yes. But also tells you you have room to grow. It shows you where you're at. Isn't that pretty cool? You think about it? You can have joy in a trial because you have an eternity to spend with Christ, so it's all temporary anyway. And even in the temporary, this is growing you. Let's just look at a few men in the Bible that had opportunities. Abraham. You guys know Abraham, right? Not personally, but you know of him, right? Waited 25 years for a son. Went through all sorts of up and downs, right? Has a son. And then in Genesis 22, what does God say? Sacrifice him. And the text tells us, but Abraham didn't know it at the time, the text tells us that God was testing, seeing where his faith was. Interestingly enough, James will use Abraham and Genesis 22 in chapter 2 to talk about a genuine, true faith. Take your son, your only son, the son whom you love, and sacrifice him, the son whom you've waited for. That's a trial. Moses. Think about Moses. When you think of Moses, maybe you think of like the old cartoon Disney thing. Was it Disney? I don't know who made it, but Prince of Egypt. Moses. Most of his life was spent in the wilderness. Most of his life. I mean, he was taken out of a nice little basket. That's a great story, right? Out of the basket, into Pharaoh's palace, raised as one of Pharaoh's, kills an Egyptian, goes and lives for 40 years in a wilderness, shepherding stupid sheep. So he can come back to Egypt and take a bunch of people into the wilderness, and so he can spend 40 years shepherding stupid sheep. I mean, those 40 years in the wilderness prior, good testing and growing. And think about how many, how many conversations did Moses have in 40 years with the sheep? Just thinking, I had it all in Egypt. 40 years, and then 40 years. Israel, 40 years in the wilderness. I mean, imagine having to eat manna for 40 years. Imagine eating anything for 40 years. I mean, after about a week, turkey is, you know, pushing it for Thanksgiving, right? 40 years of manna. And they were tested over and over again to see whether they would trust. And they failed a lot of those tests. Job, he's, you think of testing, that guy. I mean, Satan's up in heaven in the first two chapters. And God says, have you seen Job? And Satan says, well, and this is my interpretation/translation. And Satan says, well, I can't do anything because you're protecting him. And God says, okay, have at him, just don't kill him. What's Job lose? Everything except his wife. Right? And then she says, curse God and die. Like, you're miserable. Just die. Lost everything. Did Job learn a lot? I tell you what Job learned. God shows up in a whirlwind after all of Job's complaints. God shows up in a whirlwind and he says, hey, Job, gird up your loins. You answer me. Stand up. Act like a man. You talk to me. Where were you when I created dot, dot, dot? That's the last part of Job. You know what Job's response is? Hey, that was cool. He puts his hand over his mouth. He said, yeah, I've learned a lot. And the first thing I've learned is don't question God. Job. Peter. This is probably one of the most vivid. I just think through Peter's life. Peter is excited. Peter is headed to Jerusalem. Peter is with the Messiah going to Jerusalem. And Peter thinks Jesus is getting on his throne and reigning. And he's going to be a part. That's what Peter's thinking on the road. And Jesus says, Peter, Satan has asked permission to sift you like wheat. For most of us, that doesn't mean anything. In the common vernacular, Satan has asked to pick you apart and test you. Wow. Imagine hearing that from Jesus. Satan has demanded to test you and pick you apart. In Luke chapter 22, verse 31. And you know what Jesus says? But I prayed for you and for your faith. I just imagine, what is Peter thinking? Whoa, wait. I didn't catch that part. Satan's asked what? To sift me like wheat? And then later on in the story, a little girl scares Peter into denying Jesus three times. And yet I love the scene at the end of John in which Peter brings him back, or Jesus brings Peter back. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? You know all things. Restoring Peter. And then in Peter, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6, he says the same thing as James. Count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, because it's a testing of your faith. And at the end of it, hopefully you'll have passed and you'll have praise and glory and honor brought to Christ. That's basically what he says in chapter 1 of Peter. Paul, who knows what this thorn is? Everybody has an idea. Is it a person? Is it a demon? Is it a real thorn? Is it an eye problem? What is it? What we do know is that Paul didn't like it. How do you know Paul didn't like it? Take it away. Three times. God says no. What did Paul learn in that? 2 Corinthians chapter 12. In the same context, I asked three times, didn't take it away. And God tells me, told him, my grace is sufficient. For power is perfected in weakness. That's what Paul learned in his trial. Do you think he was thankful for that thorn? Think of the spiritual lessons of learning to be sustained on God's grace, even in the midst of your most difficult times. The advantage of trials. What are the advantages of trials? They are opportunities. I'll do it again because I know it's getting late. It's like 11:40. They are opportunities, right? Opportunities for growth. Opportunities to show you where you're at spiritually. And here's the kicker. You are not as mature as you think you are. Oof, that does not win me friends when I say that. And I say that from experience. Especially these last few months, they've been a challenge for me in my life and in a number of areas and working through James this last semester and coming to the realization as I'm going through these trials, and I see myself as a seminary graduate, and I'm in ministry, and I get to do all these things, and realizing that I'm not as mature as I think I am. Realizing because the pressure is squeezing, and I'm seeing stuff come out, and realizing there's growth to be had. And I guarantee it, I don't guarantee much, but I guarantee that all of us are not as mature as we should be, at the very least. That we're lacking, that we fail in our responses, that when trials and pressures and difficulties come, that what comes out probably isn't good sometimes. And it reveals to us that we are lacking. Look at the end of verse 4. And let endurance have its perfect results so that you may be perfect and complete, or mature and whole, lacking in nothing. And then here's the part that I love, the assistance for trials. In verse 5, but if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. Here's the thing. All of us lack in some way. All of us. There's not a person in here who responds maturely to every difficulty in life at all times. So when you lack, what do? You ask. You ask. I love how James phrases it in the original. He says, ask the giving God. How cool is that term? I mean, we have all sorts of terms and phrases for God, but the giving God? Ask the giving God, and he'll generously and without reproach give. What does it mean to give without reproach? Have you ever asked for help and gotten in trouble? Of course you have. You've lived life. Hey, I don't know. You should know. Hey, I need help. No. Do it on your own. You're not going to get in trouble when you go before God and you ask for help. That's what James is saying. The giving God is going to give generously without hesitation, and he's not going to reproach you for it, rebuke you. Ask for what in particular? Wisdom. Hey, think about that. That's perfect, right? Because you need to wisely navigate all of life in a mature and God-honoring way. So when you lack, what do you need the most? You need wisdom the most. If you don't have joy in trials, if you're suffering and going through difficulties and it's coming out and there's ungodly things coming out of you, there are immature things, responses coming out of you, it means you lack wisdom. It means you lack and you need to ask. Wisdom. One of the things I love about James is that he doesn't leave things just out there. He defines wisdom in chapter 3. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. So if you're wise, it'll show in your deeds. And this is what wisdom will look like. It's from above, and it's pure, it's peaceable, it's gentle, it's reasonable, it's full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy, and the seed whose fruit is righteous is sown in peace by those who make peace. When you lack, in your response to trials, ask for wisdom. And then he continues on. So not only what do you ask for, but how do you ask? Verses 6, 7, and 8. But he must ask in faith without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. And so not only do you ask for wisdom, but there's a way in which James is telling us to go before the Lord and ask. And it's simple. Ask in faith, trust. Because the person that doesn't ask with trust, believing that God will give and God will do, the person that wavers, that waffles, that is like the sea driven back and forth. Imagine, just think, a little leaf on a raging sea. What happens to that leaf? It goes everywhere, back and forth, unstable. That's why James is going to use a very interesting phrase, double-minded man. unstable in all his ways. That term for double-minded is literally, basically, two-souled. Here's the point. When you're maturing and whole, you lack nothing. But in your immature response, and especially when you don't ask in faith, you are like a two-personed person. One of you trusts, the other doesn't. Now, if you were to ask a person to walk in two opposite directions at the same time, what happens? I would demonstrate it, but I'm in a suit. What happens when one person is asked to walk into two different directions? It's impossible, right? It's unstable. And that's James' point, is that when you ask, don't ask with, well, you know, I believe, but yeah, I don't believe. Yeah, but I believe, but I don't believe. He loves me not. Trust, believe. So ask for wisdom. Trust in him. And who does this apply to? Short answer is everybody, right? In James' context, two significant groups come up all the time in the book of James. The poor and the rich. Those two people come up all the time. Chapter 2, the poor have to sit in the back. They got smelly clothes. They don't look that great. When the rich man comes, he's brought to the front. The poor man is brought up to be a footstool. James chapter 2, don't be impartial. James chapter 5, the poor man is being denied his wages. The rich are not paying the poor. In fact, some of the poor are dying, are being murdered. Over and over again, James is going to basically address these two groups. So as he's dealing with how do you deal with trials in your life, he goes to a section that for the longest time I had a hard time connecting. How does verses 9 and through 11 of the poor man in his exalted position and the rich man in his humbled, how does that connect? It's basically this. Both poor and rich go through trials. And you're like, well, I'd like to go through the rich guy's trial. But both poor and rich go through trials. Both need wisdom in how to navigate the difficulties and challenges in life. What does the poor guy go through? Look at verse 9. But the brother of humble circumstance is to glory in his high position. What's his high position? Look at verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 5. Listen, my beloved brethren. Did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and the heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? Again, we're coming back to that theme of temporary versus eternal. What has God made the poor man? Well, he's rich in faith and he's heirs of the kingdom. What's the poor man's high position? He, though temporary, is low and nothing in the world's eyes, he has eternity, and in particular, the kingdom to inherit. Would you trade momentary riches for eternal splendor with God? The right answer is yeah, right? That's the right answer. And so James is reminding the poor person that even in all of your trials, remember that though you're low, you are exalted. And then, that's amazing. And then the second part, verse 10. And the rich man is to glory in his humiliation because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. Again, we know this definitely a Jewish audience because he's highlighting a situation that happens in Israel. A flower will spurt out in the desert, the sun comes out, and there is a horrendous heat, wind type thing that blows through and withers up the little beautiful flower that popped up. So what's James telling the rich person to be reminded of? Later on, he's going to use a term that we're all familiar with. Life is like a vapor. It's done. Even in the midst of the rich man's pursuits, he will fade away. So the rich person has to go through trials too. The rich are tempted oftentimes with comfort and ease of this temporary world. The rich are often tempted to be independent of God, thinking their own selves to be worthy because of their riches. I mean, that is typical biblical instruction that goes on and on and on about rich people. Look at what Paul will say for the rich person. Instruct those who are rich in this present world. Again, this temporary versus eternal. Not to be conceited or fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. Just a few months ago, I was going through James chapter 5, and I did a study on how the poorest of America compares to the rest of the world. And the poorest of Americans, I mean, the poorest of the poor of Americans are in the 2% of the richest people in the world. It's amazing when you think of that. That's crazy. But then it makes sense when the statistics are that most people in the world live on less than a dollar a day. Most people. So if that's less than a dollar a day, what are they living on? Less than $365 a year. So, if you're poor, you're not that poor. In fact, you're probably rich. Probably. Riches, wealth, comfort, ease, have a tendency to make us comfortable in this world and lose an eternal perspective. And that's what James is getting at. Is that the poor who are suffering, the poor who are being drugged to the front, used as a footstool, the poor who are not being paid their wages, the poor who are even going to court and even being murdered, those poor, according to James, have an eternal perspective to look forward to. And the rich who have lots of stuff are to be reminded this is all temporary, and as companion with Paul, that we should be looking eternally and storing up for themselves treasure of good foundation. So what's all this mean? This. We can be joyful in the difficulties of life because we know that trials are opportunities which grow and mature us in the present and point us to eternity. But here's the thing, folks. If you're a Christian, that's true. You have eternity to look forward to. If you're an unbeliever, eternity is not something to look forward to. Separation and eternal damnation from God. So as believers, we can look at the temporary difficulties of life. And I've read a lot of people going through difficulties. A few days before Christmas. No, Christmas Day, I should say. Sorry, Christmas Day, I read a post about a guy that had cancer. He's in his 40s, two beautiful girls, wonderful wife, got skin cancer, died within a year. He died on Christmas Eve with his wife curled up next to him. He had had Christmas the day before, barely enough strength to be brought out into the chair to see people open up gifts, and then he was just so tired and exhausted, and he was really in hospice to the end of his life. Brought back into his bed. His wife, knowing that it's probably the last hours of his life, crawled into bed, fell asleep. He dies. I read this whole thing. I'm in tears. I'm bawling. I mean, just, I'm a crier. And, I mean, I'm from Jersey and I like football, but I like to cry. And I'm crying. But I'm so encouraged. Because what they're writing is an eternal perspective, looking to God. But if you don't have God, you don't have that. And if you have God, you can have joy. in trials, whether it's losing an unborn child. And I've had friends have that happen. Whether it's a loved one dying, whether you're going through difficulties and pain and health issues, or your family person, somebody who you love is, whether you have job issues or you know people, you have the ability to have joy because it's a mental work knowing that we have a future in heaven and that these trials are opportunities to grow us, to show us where we need to grow, to help us get there, and we have the ability to ask a giving God for help. Happy New Year's. Because who knows what's coming? But we do know the one who holds all things in his hands. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for being good to us and giving us your word and challenging us with James, being reminded that we can have joy. We're commanded to have joy. You've reminded us of the advantages of the trials that you allow into our lives, and that you've reminded us that there's assistance in the midst of trials. And when we lack to come to you, a giving, generous, gracious God. So Father, whether we're going through trials now or we will in the future, may we be reminded of these truths. May we move them into action. Thank you for these people. And I pray that your people are encouraged by your word. In your son's name, amen. Have a great Sunday.